Good afternoon, everyone. Today is April 16, 2015, and this is a subcommittee of Ways and Means Public Safety. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5516 and invite the Attorney General up or her designee.
I'm going to ask for my designee to appear.
Excellent. So we are not going to do the work session until we have another senator. Sorry.
Oh, okay. We misunderstood.
No, you understood. I just wasn't telling
Thank
you the
you,
thing that
Chair.
I just did.
Thank you.
Great.
What page are we on?
So we are both designated.
Yes, for you. Thank you.
You as a senior member.
No, I see it. I'm sorry. I see it.
God almighty. I'm going to get after mine. I wasn't going to speak today, but
that was Kenny Guy.
Yeah,
he'll say that.
I wasn't going to speak today, but
well, the other one is.
Okay.
19 different.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kate Cooper Richardson, Administrator of the Division of Child Support at the Oregon Department of Justice and the Director of the Oregon Child Support Program. I'm here to talk.
And for the record, my name is Fred Boss. I am the Deputy Attorney General, and I'm sitting next to Ms. Richardson.
Also known as my moral support. I'm here to talk to you today about the funding breakdown of the division and the division's policy package, and of course the 10% reduction scenario, which is very scary indeed. Just a little foreshadowing there. Here is an overview of the structure of the Division of Child Support, and you've seen this before. This org chart represents 576 employees. Division's divided in three sections, and I discussed those responsibilities in my earlier presentation. Also shown here is what is becoming not unlike a fourth section, the Child Support System Project, which has both dedicated state staff and contractor staff and is headed by Karen Coleman as project executive. She sits on my executive team. Not shown here is the team of 9 full-time AAGs from the Civil Enforcement Division who provide legal services for the Division of Child Support, and of course the 25 DA offices that contract with the Department of Justice to provide child support services. And collectively, the Division of Child Support and those 25 district attorney offices are known as the Oregon Child Support Program. Moving on to fund types. As you've seen with the other divisions, here's a breakdown of our fund types and the comparisons with the 11-13 legislative approved budget and the 13-15 current services level. The Division of Child Support receives more general fund than the other divisions of DOJ, but it also gets a double match on each dollar of general fund. You can see that the funding levels in the governor's budget and the modified agency request budget match. Our policy package was included in the governor's budget. The change in the general fund between the LAB and the CSL captures the roll-up impact of the debt service on the general obligation bonds that were issued this biennium, because those are ongoing obligations. The other funds increase for the next biennium is the capital funding for the upcoming issuances of general obligation bonds for the system project, and then the significant increase in federal funds is the match to those other funds or the bond proceeds for the next biennium. The Division of Child Support current service level takes the base budget and applies the essential packages. Package 22 phases out the costs of issuance for the bonds issued in this biennium. Those are a one-time cost from the CSL. The cost of issuance for future bonds are in the policy package. For the Division of Child Support, $2.18 million is the amount to account for that mysterious standard and above standard inflation for the Division of Child Support, state government services, and the like. So I'm here to talk about just one little policy package, but is one that was contemplated by the last legislature to be forthcoming in this session. Policy package 201 is in the governor's budget, as I said, which is why the amounts of the governor's budget and our agency request are the same. The total amount of the package is $47 million. Only $2.1 million of that is general fund. The $2.1 million in general fund reauthorizes the debt service payments on the bonds issued for the child support system project to date, general obligation bonds, and to a lesser extent also authorizes debt service owed in this biennium on any bonds issued in 15-17. The other funds limitation on the policy package authorizes payment of the cost of issuance for bonds issued in the upcoming biennium, plus expenditure limitation for the capital proceeds of those bonds. And of course, the federal federal funds expenditure limitation is for authority to spend the matching federal dollars. You can see the breakdown again here. Well, actually you can't because I was one slide back. But there we go. You can see that now you can see the breakdown here between general fund, bond finance, debt service, the bond financing, and the federal funds. And as I talked about before, we've been working on the Division of Child Support since 2010, has been working on a multi-year federally prescribed process alongside with our federal oversight office to replace our federally certified system that we must have to have a modern federally certified system. And the 2013 Legislative Assembly approved the state portion of funding toward the replacement project using capital bonds for that first biennium. So package 201 allows the project to continue into the next phases, and it is required for the federal matching dollars on the project. Ultimately, the new system will allow the program to stay in compliance with the federal requirements, compete for federal incentives, and keep up with increasing caseload demands. And you'll notice that there are no positions associated with the policy package because, it's not that there aren't people working on it, because there are. It doesn't just happen magically, but there are limited duration staff, or the cost of covering staff dedicated to the project are funded through the bond proceeds. And so those are established through the administrative processes, which is standard with the capital bonding.
Madam Chair.
Representative Woodsnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, I'm sorry, I've been away from public safety ways and means for some time. What are we bonding? We're bonding to pay the child support till we collect it from the people. Is that what are we? I don't understand what we're bonding in for child support.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Wisnett. Well, from my our prior interactions when I was in
which
the state treasurer's office, yes, we know that we can't, or really ought not, to be bonding for any operating budget. And so this is not for the bonds that were issued in the last biennium and are contemplated in this in the future biennium are not for operating costs, but for the replacement of the whole system itself. It's the build, the planning, the building, the design, and that does take people, though. And so those are attached to one time, not the regular business of the project. In the way, though, they are paying for the backfill for the regular business. So it pulls, if we need to be pulling some of our staff into the project full time, that is a cost of the project. It may mean that we're paying for the backfill persons to do it, but it's still part of the one-time project costs. Did I answer your question?
It's a computer system.
It's a computer system.
Yes. Okay. We're bonding the. Okay.
Excuse me. Co-Chair Williamson, Representative Woodsnett. It is. It's a computer system. System, but it's really our business. It is that federally certified system that is account management, case management. It does everything.
I'm sorry. Thank you. I didn't.
That's okay.
I thought we were doing the payout for the child support.
We can't pay out if we don't have the system. So in a way, it's true.
Thank you for covering for me.
Sure. okay, so here's what we've done to date on the project. And these are investments that the legislature and the Department of Justice has made to date. So we did have that year-long feasibility study report by an independent expert vendor to help develop the business case and assist us in identifying what sort of system Oregon needs, the computer system. In the 2012 short session, the legislature approved funding for a business process reengineering study, and we completed that with an expert vendor to make sure we were designing a system for the future, not one based on workarounds on our current system. And then last session, we had the implementation approval through the legislature. Thank you very much. And our request here does contemplate bond financing, but of course the actual method is your prerogative. So if you just want to hand over general fund, that would be fine. But we are anticipating you'd like to continue the prior commitment to the bonds. And of course, the feds are picking up 66%. I like to keep repeating that fact. So right now, we are we're done with our business process reengineering, but we are preparing for the design and development of the new system by reviewing all the 2B processes that came out of that that BPR to determine whether a law or rule change is necessary and to review the associated forms. We're very, very, very close to having all the procurements completed. Maximus is on board already as our project management contractor, and they're working on development of the foundational documents and bringing on organizational change management staff and business analysts. We are in very earnest contract negotiations with Deloitte as the systems system integrator for the project, which is the big implementation vendor. And in fact, we have three full days of negotiations next week. We've set a goal to having a fully executed contract by the end of June, which includes federal approval of the contract, which is necessary before the state can sign. And then the contract with CSG Government Solutions as the quality assurance contractor is right now at the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement for its final review and approval, and we expect that very shortly and are targeting a May 1st start date.
Senator Shields.
So it seems like the feds are a very big partner, not just in funds, but also in oversight. Have other states engaged in this so that we can learn from them, or are we kind of out there on our own to do this?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, we are not flying blind. In fact, I think we're in a very a fortuitous position because our Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement has put in place a very strict process to rebuild new systems and, in fact, require all states to use that, and a number of them, many of them have. It's not unlike an iterative process where you're required to visit states and programs that have had recent upgrades or modernizations, if you will. And we did do that as part of ours, and in fact are bringing in components from some of the newer states, and they do have to all go through a certification process at the end. It is a hand-in-glove relationships, absolutely, and to have those kind of sideboards and direction and step-by-step actually makes this job much easier. No system, no state system has failed once the feds put this into place quite a few years ago now.
Good.
Yeah, I like to say that too. So we'll be starting that joint application design, JAD, and joint technical design training sessions upcoming, but we've already got the training going for that right away. So here's a segmented schedule as it exists right now. There are a number of schedules that overlap, and what you're not seeing here is what all the pre-project planning and preparation going back to 2010. The feasibility study, which was started in 2010 and completed near the end of 2012, and the implementation advanced planning document, which is part of that federally required process, that's what fell into that pre-planning or project preparation period. So in the upper right, you see our business process reengineering schedule. It's all complete, but we are now taking what came out of it to implement what we can do right now that's not system related, and then preparing to feed the rest of it into the implementation. The procurement calendar, 97% complete. I'm very excited about that. There was a lot of research and planning and development with DOJ, the State Procurement Office, that was necessary to publish high quality RFPs for these contractors. And the more investment we put in the RFP and in the statements of work, the higher quality the proposals, and the higher quality the proposal, the easier it is to hammer out a contract that is very clear about what Oregon needs and wants. And I'm really confident that the upfront work we're doing on that will pay dividends throughout the project. And then the long implementation project timeline. It's starting last fall with the procurement and planning, and then design will begin soon. Testing the end of next year, rollout anticipated 3 years from now, and certification 4 years from now. Now I say that, but that's as it is right now. There will be a re-baseline of the schedule after the system integrator is on board. So in the next biennium, we'll wrap up bringing on board the contractors, and so I might get a little wonky here with some of these project management language. I never thought I would be using some of these terms. Among the first deliverables for the system integrator is to stand up a project facility to house the entire project team, including integrator staff, project management and quality assurance contractor staff, and all the program staff dedicated to the project. The thoughtful planning that's taking place now in the JAD and JTD sessions starting this summer will provide quality training to our functional and technical SMEs, our subject matter experts. That's really imperative, so they understand their important role of eliciting, clarifying, and validating the hundreds and really thousands of functional and technical requirements that will be used to deliver the system functionality to meet, or I'm intending to exceed, the goals of the project. And then the system build, which is the development or construction phase of the project, is scheduled to begin about a year from now. User acceptor testing, as I said, would be 2017, and that's been well on its way. And, okay, here we are at the site of the parade of horribles. But it's really a 10% reduction really would have a cascading effect that would reach down to the vulnerable families we serve. I mean, we really are putting food on people's tables. So we have a tested calculation or a formula that we use to measure the effect of a reduction. I also believe it would work in the converse. So if you want to provide a 10% increase, we would expect, we would do a lot with that. The formula relies on federally audited data and uses FTE, total collections numbers, program caseload, and the number of modifications and order establishments to measure the effect of a loss of funds. So a general fund cut for us is extra deep in the Division of Child Support because it also results in the loss of that federal match, because every dollar of general fund is actually a loss of $3 in total funds. So that would be a loss of 60 positions throughout the Division of Child Support. That would lead to closure of one of our offices. We have 12 offices around the state. It would reduce child support collections by $34 million in 2015-17, and $3.7 million reduction in recoveries for state agencies, because we also do recover public assistance funds for TANF and for Medicaid. And so, of course, then the loss would be compounded by leading to decreased performance, loss of our incentive funds, fewer federal funds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it would also result in a loss to the county district attorney offices as well. And as you know, the county budgets are stretched already very thin and could result, in fact, in a possible transfer of a county program to the Department of Justice where they would discontinue their contract. We did recently have a transfer from Klamath County back to the state. And the district attorney and the county commissioners decided that would be their best solution under the circumstances, and they do rely on the funding that they get through the federal government and through the state to run their child support options. That's all I have at this time, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to go a little out of order, and I am actually going to open a work session on the Department of Justice, Department of Human Services report, child welfare caseworker representation.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Joanne Southey. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also the acting attorney in charge of the child advocacy section, and those are the attorneys that represent the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program. The joint budget note submitted by the Department of Justice and the Department of Human Services addresses the need for legal representation of the DHS Child Welfare Program. Current law that authorizes DHS caseworkers to appear in court unrepresented without legal counsel in all juvenile dependency proceedings will sunset June 30th of 2015. As background, in December 2013, various court judges from different counties raised concerns that DHS is required to be represented by an attorney at every single juvenile court proceeding. Some of those judges also indicated they would not allow DHS to appear without an assistant attorney general present. Due to the limited time frame to address that issue prior to the 2014 short legislative session, at that time, the 2014 legislature passed House Bill 4156, which allows DHS to appear without legal counsel in certain limited circumstances. That law was passed as a compromise with input from a variety of juvenile dependency partners, including the Oregon Judicial Department. The intent and direction at that time was to examine the legal representation issue over that next year and prior to the sunset of June 2015. DHS and DOJ as partner agencies, along with others, met to determine the most appropriate resolution to that legal representation issue and its fiscal implications. Currently, DHS routinely appears without legal counsel at juvenile court hearings. In contrast, with the exception of an initial shelter hearing in certain counties, the parents and attorneys are each separately represented by counsel at every other hearing throughout the life of a juvenile dependency case. When caseworkers appear in court without an attorney, they can simply be reporting facts to the court, while the other parties have the benefit of having a legal advocate strongly representing their position. DHS caseworkers are not legally educated, nor are they trained to interpret the law, nor represent their agency in court, nor realize the impact of their particular juvenile case on the agency as a whole. Caseworkers often make decisions in court with significant legal impact on children and families, and then without the benefit of legal counsel, must defend or justify those decisions upon questioning from the court and also upon direct examination from other attorneys in the courtroom. The balance is tipped against DHS, and yet DHS has the burden of proof in the vast majority of these cases. DHS must continue to demonstrate there is a need for the state to be involved with a child and family. In addition, appeals of a juvenile case with an inadequate record can delay permanency for a child for up to a year. Those decisions often then require a remand back to the juvenile dependency court to be retried with legal counsel present. Lack of legal representation of caseworkers in court can result in delayed permanency for children, either in delaying the return of a child to a safe parent or to delaying the return or transition into another more appropriate permanent plan. In addition, lack of legal representation results in a cost to the state for continuing the child in subsidized state care, for additional court time, as well as for additional parent and children's attorney time. And perhaps most importantly, lack of legal representation can affect child safety. There are issues that arise in court, which DHS caseworkers are not always able to predict, and their ability to advocate at last minute or emergency issues can be hampered by a lack of legal knowledge or training. The budget note offers various options to provide full legal representation by DOJ for the DHS Child Welfare Program. All three options provide for a rolling sunset to allow a staged, phased implementation over the next two biennia. In conclusion, DHS caseworkers must provide social work services to children and families and are charged with the responsibility of protecting some of Oregon's most vulnerable citizens from greater harm. They must also ensure children achieve permanency along federally mandated timelines through legal guardianships and adoption, and strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families whenever possible. Attorneys, on the other hand, are charged with advocating for a specific legal position on behalf of a party, ensuring their clients understand and follow the law, obey court orders, and in this case, obey their agency's own rules and policies. Attorneys must be competent and objective, and as an attorney for the state agency, ensure statewide consistency and fairness. Children and families should be treated the same legally, whether that child is placed into state care in Marion County, Malheur County, or Coos County. Without a resolution, DHS caseworkers will not be allowed to appear in court without an attorney by June of 2015. The appropriate funding and staffing authority is required to ensure that we do not create an untenable situation for the state and for our children in state foster care. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Any questions?
Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Chairs Shields and Williamson, Rest Committee, and I'm Jerry Weybrandt, the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency. The equivalence of what she said is why I'm sitting here. And if you have any questions, to assist you with those.
Okay. I'll start. I think I'm wrestling with this. It's what, $15 million? Is that what we're looking at cost-wise?
Yeah, the Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williamson, this is the staged implementation is meant to reduce the cost to the state all at once, so it is rolled out. So I believe the next biennia, the cost would be about $7 million, and then increasing into the next biennia.
And I guess my angst is that if I said to most of the people in this room, if you could come up, if you had $7 million to improve fostering in the state, how would you do it? And I'm not sure that there'd be many people who'd say we need to give better representation at DHS to accomplish that for kids. So I, you know, as I look at the report, it seems like the only option out there is that we need more lawyers for full representation. And I think we'll probably approve acceptance of the report, but I think we'd really like you guys to go back to the table, push you together, and see if we can come up with some other path besides just fully representing DHS in all of these proceedings. I think there's got to be a way to figure out a path that, you know, could be less onerous legally. Could there be a way where you, you know, not have lawyers in every single court proceeding, but with notice, maybe, okay, this is one where you're really going to need one? I mean, as a foster parent, like you said, a lot of these proceedings are really just reporting back to the court on, you know, the progress on a particular case. And it doesn't seem like, in my experience, which again is limited and I don't want to read too much into it, but that there's got to be a way that we can carve a middle ground, because I just can't see there being a whole lot of support for coming up with $7 million.
And I share my co-chair's concern. What I see in this report is an option around budgeting and not necessarily an option around policy and structure of the system. And so we, Senator Shields and I have had conversations about, is there a way to change the definition of meetings, reports, whether or not you give notice to the other party about you know, the proceedings before, so that you don't have to have the kind of legal representation at every meeting or every appearance as outlined here. Is there a structural way to get at this? Because if I were to take the temperature of my side of the world, I don't know that a new extending the sunset is something that folks are comfortable with. And in this budget arena and at this time in our budget, this is a difficult, difficult thing to do.
And ma'am, oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. This came about as a result of a couple of circuit court judges, as I understand, not allowing DHS staff to represent themselves. Is that kind of where it started?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Krieger, that is correct. That's how this first came to light, at which point the Department of Justice took a closer look along with DHS at the relevant statutes and determined that that is the current state of the law, even though there had been a status quo that had kind of morphed over the years.
Mm-hmm. With that in mind, if we're going to allow them to do something different, we're going to have to make sure that the law allows them to do something different.
Right, and we will have a Senate bill in this committee where we can implement some, we have some a vehicle to deal with this if we can come to an agreement.
And just go on, you know, you got the pilot project they're talking about with six counties where everybody's represented.
that's more or less with DHS and others. And I know in one work group I was in, we were talking about caseworkers. Did they have any type of legal training to appear in a courtroom? Are they exposed to it? One of the judges was part of that group suggested that we have during a session at colleges that they would have the DAs, the judges, would have a couple of weeks with them, and then the defense bar to explain to them how they work, the work that they do, how it fits in the entire legal system. Most of these young people, you know, they could be kind of a starter job, 22 to 27, 8 years old. A lot of them kind of burn out after that. It's a tough job with DHS doing that kind of work. You see a lot of negative every day. Drugs, abuse women, abuse children. So I would suggest that we do look into further that they have that exposure, the training, so they understand what they do as a caseworker, how it's going to affect the family and the kids. They are not to be judge and jury, and we've had a few of them try to be a judge and a jury to manipulate the process. It's caused a lot of grief. So, you know, if we're going to do something and allow, there's a certain amount of expense, getting to my favorite word, which is justice. It isn't cheap, but in the long run, you may, if we make mistakes with the foster children, the kids going in and out of homes, not getting to permanency as fast as we should, and something like 60 or 70% of the kids in foster care end up in the judicial system also. So there's a whole cost to this, and we need to be thinking long term, not just this $15 million or whatever it might be.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
I'm not going to say much you probably haven't heard already. This is a clash of two budgets in some ways. I chair the committee with Representative Nathanson that is looking at this from the other side to a certain degree. We want to make sure that the Department of Justice and DHS maintain good relationships over this. You rely on each other for information, and the key here is the children. You know, we end up having have to supply attorneys for the parents, the child, DHS, and we're paying for the judge, too. It's getting pretty expensive. And yet, at the same time, these are really sensitive cases of situations where often you wonder if DHS wasn't aggressive enough or they were too aggressive, and it's very difficult to call these shots. It's really, really difficult. All that said, I'm going to go with my co-chairs here on this side, that many of the times we are just looking at a reporting situation, and it seems to me there's an area there that if you're just doing a report, you don't need representation, but as soon as it moves past that, you've got to stop proceedings, lose some time, and come back in. Now, I don't know if you can set it up ahead of time to do that or not. I'm not an attorney, but it seems to me there's some ground there for doing it. One of the things we frankly heard in talking to some people that are involved in the system, sometimes the most important report is not from DHS or the attorneys, but from the CASA worker. And I would like to see us move to getting a CASA assigned to every single one of these kids as their advocate who can give a report to a judge and all the attorneys involved. Sometimes they give the most succinct, short two-pager that really makes sense of what we've been told. And that's not against what attorneys do, but, you know, when I sign my mortgage for my house, I have no idea what I'm signing, okay? You know, and it kind of gets that way because you have to be that way. You're doing a legal document that may have ramifications 6 years later, and I understand that. But I think there is a middle ground here, and I'm hoping that both sides can work to find that for us. And if we get to that middle ground, we'll have something that will work better for the children, and that's really it's really all about.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And also, I mean, this isn't in either budget. I mean, this would be $7 million we'd have to come up with somewhere else.
It'd be in the DHS, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah.
It'd be in the DHS budget. We'd have to budget for it. We presently have a $140 million hole in that budget right now. This would make it 150 55, if my math is correct, or thereabouts. So it's another piece for us to work with.
Right. And Co-Chair, if I could, my point just being that there's no policy option package to fund.
No.
And that has me concerned.
Just briefly.
Right ahead, yes.
Co-Chair Williamson, Shields, and members of the committee, just to address a couple of the points briefly, is that I understand the perception from a lot of people is that this is a reporting situation where caseworkers are just reporting to the court. A lot of these hearings that are required federally are review hearings and permanency hearings, each of which require mandated findings. And the permanency judgment alone that the court must fill out, or is in some counties requesting the DHS caseworker fill out, is 9 pages of legal findings. There's a lot of complexities to this law that keeps increasing, and the appellate decisions that come down are really adding a twist to make this not just a reporting about how things are going, but legally and constitutionally, is the state agency following its rules and policies and the law. In addition, just to clarify for those who may not be familiar, in Oregon, children's attorneys are advocating for their client, the child. So ethically, if their child is under a certain age, they advocate for the child's best interest. If the child is of a certain age or above, which can be 6, 7, 8, depending on the age of the child, they are ethically required to go in and advocate what their client wants, their stated interest. So you have children's attorneys arguing for what many people would maybe believe would not be in the best interest of the child. So when the agency is advocating in court, or not being able to advocate in court, there was no one potentially presenting evidence or arguing for what is in the best interest of that child. Just want to get those things out there.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt of the report.
Madam Co-Chair. Are you ready for a motion now?
Sure.
I move the LFO recommendation.
Senator Shields moves the LFO recommendation. Any questions? Any objections? So moved. All right, I'm going to close that work session. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 5516.
You weren't certain what you heard.
No, I'm not. I'm going to have to go out in the hall and ask her.
I know.
I'm a little confused what she said.
It went okay for a while, and then it went off.
Then it went, and so I'm going to meet her outside here in a minute if she has left the building. And I want clarity. You know? I haven't got a dog in this, but I just want those kids taken care of.
Right.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lippold. I'm Chief Counsel of the Trial Division at the Department of Justice. And we're here back in phase two. I just want to give you a brief synopsis again that the Trial Division is the section of the Department of Justice which defends the state, its agencies, and its officials in civil court, both in federal and state civil court. When folks are suing the state, we're the attorneys that show up to defend the state and its folks. We have slide 65 here, which is our organizational chart. This is how we are, the first three lines show you how we are currently set up. The fourth line provides the additional personnel that we are asking for within our policy package 161. That policy package is within the governor's budget, and we're not asking for anything more than the governor's already approved. Moving to slide 66 shows you, as we have with the other sections and divisions, where our funds come from. All of the funds come from other funds within our division, those billings that we accrue by working for the agencies and the folks that we represent. Slide 67 brings us to our current service level. As we've talked about before, this gives you a general idea of where we are today. We're at 98 individuals, shows you our budget, and shows you where we will be once you add the standard inflation and other add-ins for the next biennium. And slide 68, where we get to talking about our policy package, which is the request for additional personnel. Slide 69 really breaks that down for you.
Then you add on to that.
The first thing that we would like to do within this package is reclassify six of our word processor positions to legal secretary positions. This is to rectify an unequal pay scale. The Human Resources Department of the Department of Justice has recently reviewed those divisions and found them to be on par with the legal secretary position, entitling those word processors to a higher pay scale. So we would like to do that for them. The second request is for additional attorneys and paralegals and support staff. Currently, we have a need for, we believe, five lawyers in the next biennium. In the civil litigation section, for example, our lawyers have put in, over the last biennium, 4,400 hours of additional time above their required hours. Our special litigation section has put in about 1,800 hours above what is required of the lawyers. What that adds up to is in the last biennium, we are about 1.5 lawyers short in performing the work that needs to be performed based on our agreement with the union. As a result of that, we have a need for 1.5 lawyers immediately, and with growth in those two sections of about 3% over the last several years, we anticipate that at that rate and that trend, we're probably going to need another 1.5 to 2 lawyers before the end of the next biennium. We also expect that we are going to need a half to an extra attorney for our defensive agency orders section. In this next biennium, we are going to be faced with dealing with the agreement reached in the Klamath Basin adjudication. Our defensive agency orders section will be the lawyers that will be handling all of the contested cases that arise out of that. We don't quite know yet what kind of a landslide of contested cases we're going to see in that, but we anticipate quite a bit. And so that's why we are forecasting that we're going to have an additional need there. With all of that, the additional lawyers, we have an additional need for two paralegals. Currently, our paralegals are working over 200 hours of overtime a month going back over the last 2 years. That means that we have a current immediate need for one paralegal. We expect that we will have a need for one additional paralegal in the upcoming biennium. These are the folks that, frankly, wade through the mountain of documents that we face in almost every case litigated these days, oftentimes going through hundreds of thousands of documents in order to produce them to the other side, respond to public records requests, and get cases prepared when they're ready to go to trial. Finally, if we do indeed add lawyers over the next couple of years, we anticipate that we will need to add two support staff personnel, legal secretary positions, one likely to be secretarial, the other likely to be in a word processing position. If we move to the last slide, which is our budget reduction, a 5% reduction at the trial division would result in a loss of 7 FTE, likely made up of 3 lawyers, 1 paralegal, 1 legal secretary, and 2 office support specialists. A 5% reduction would call for the remaining lawyers in the office to pick up an additional 9,200 hours over the biennium and would likely push them over 2,000 hours of billable time each year. A 10% reduction would double those numbers. We would lose 6 lawyers in total, a couple of paralegals, an investigator, 2 support staff, and several office support staff. That would mean that, as I indicated before, a 30% increase in the billable hours for the lawyers that remain if there was a reduction of that kind. That concludes my remarks. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Questions? All right. You've escaped unscathed.
Not yet.
Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Anna Joyce. I'm the Oregon Solicitor General. I was here a few weeks ago talking about both the Defensive Criminal Convictions Program as well as the Appellate Division. As we talked about last time we were here, the Defensive Criminal Convictions Program straddles both the Trial Division as well as the Appellate Division. Just by way of brief reminder, what the DCC program does is work to uphold criminal convictions obtained by deputy district attorneys against challenges in both state and federal court. We also take appeals from adverse trial court rulings that might place criminal prosecutions in jeopardy, and then we also provide on-the-ground support for deputy district attorneys. The slide simply shows where our funding comes from. The DCC program is all general funded. We're looking at the next slide, an increase of about $5 million over the last biennium, primarily attributable to two things. One is the mandated caseload nature, that's package 040, which represents a slight anticipated growth in the case numbers in both the trial division and the appellate division, as well as just the standard inflation. The next slide is the dreaded reduction slide. For the DCC program, a 10% reduction represents about $2.4 million. For the appellate division, what that would mean is that we would waive appearance in approximately 240 appeals, and many more of the cases in which we appear, we would be filing briefs that are more more outline and form, much shorter, and fail to robustly protect the state's interests. Either of those options fails to save money for the state for a couple of reasons. One, if the state doesn't appear, it forces the court to do more work. What the court has to do is think of the positions and the arguments that the state would, in fact, make had we not had to waive appearance, and then determine between the state's position that they think we would have made and the defendant's arguments, which is the correct answer. That would be both unfair to the court in as much as it shifts work to them. It's unfair to defendants, and it undermines the fundamental nature of our legal system, which is adversarial in nature. It also means if the state doesn't appear, there's a much greater chance that we will simply lose the case on appeal, which then means the case has to go back to the deputy district attorney, who then has to spend further resources re-prosecuting the case if it's possible. There will be cases where if we waive appearance, we will lose and the deputy district attorney will not be able to re-prosecute that case, which means that convicted criminals will go free. A 10% reduction also means that we would have to defer about 4,000 hours of our capital work, which means we would be slowing down a group of cases that already move very slow and that are currently being challenged on constitutional grounds for, in part, how long they take. For the trial division, and I'll let Mr. Lippold talk a little bit more about that, but a reduction at 10% would mean that we would waive appearance in approximately 54 cases, which again would mean that we would lose those.
And in that, co-chairs Williamson, Shields, members of the committee. And again, as Ms. Joyce just pointed out, the concern that we have there not only is the concern of these convicted criminals being returned for resentencing or a new trial or maybe out on the street because the DAs would not be able to re-prosecute them, but it would also be fiscally, from our standpoint, irresponsible in that all of the money that had been spent up until that point in time at the DA level trying the cases, at the appellate level when there's direct appeals, by the time they get over to the trial section for PCR or Fed Habe, if we're unable to appear in those cases, in a lot of ways we've tossed hundreds of thousands of dollars down the tube. It's much more efficient, we believe, fiscally to address those cases at the level, at the PCR and Fed Habe level, with the additional funds, rather than have them go back down below. It's going to be a lot more expensive, and it will save the investment that we have had in those cases up until that point.
Questions? Yes. Sure.
Ms. Joyce, do you track how many hours in a biennium you put in on capital cases on appeal?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we do.
Do you have a sense of follow-up, how many hours that might be?
Not off the top of my head, but we can certainly get that information to you.
Thank you.
And that concludes the Defense of Criminal Convictions program. We move on to the appellate division unless there are further questions. So the appellate division, the slide simply reflects our organizational structure. As I mentioned when I was here last time, the appellate division represents the state in every case in which the state is either a party or has an interest. The vast majority of our work is the defense of criminal convictions, which I just talked about. It's about 70%. We also defend agency orders, represent the state in civil cases in which the state's a defendant, and also handle juvenile dependency and termination of parental rights appeals. In just the standard budget slide, we are primarily in the appellate division, other funded with a small amount of general fund that represents our work on ballot titles. This slide shows that our request is actually holding fairly steady. Our biggest increase is that, which is, again, the mandated caseload that I've talked about in our previous discussion. The one change is moving ballot titles, which had previously been housed in the Defense of Criminal Convictions program. I'm not actually sure why that is, but it's pretty clear that ballot titles and Defense of Criminal Convictions don't have much to do with each other. So to increase transparency, we've moved ballot titles out of the DCC program and into appellate. In terms of 10% reduction, that would be about $1.9 million. What that would mean was we would eliminate 6 attorney positions and 4 support staff positions. Much of that impact would be felt by DCC simply because, as I said, that's 70% of our caseload. It would also mean that we'd have to reduce our work on ballot titles by about 200 hours. And that concludes my brief presentation on the appellate division, unless there are any questions.
Questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
If anyone else was confused by the conversation, it's been deconfused for me. I don't know if anybody else knew the story.
Earlier around child representation.
Yeah. What happens is, and it was news to me, under the age of around 5 or 6, the attorney advocates for the child, what's best for the child. Without any significant consultation with the child, but after age about 6 or 7, they ask the child, what do you want? And they are then bound by that child's wishes to advocate for them, which can be difficult. As an example, if that child wants to go back to its father and live with the father, even though the father's been convicted of something that is, you know, child molestation or something, they are bound to advocate for that child to get it back with that father. I know that sounds crazy, but that's what the law says. I always thought it was around 11 or 12 years old, but that's what she was trying to tell us. And that age group, it changes because at that point, you listen to the child and you are there to advocate for that child. Others will advocate against that. The DHS attorney would advocate against to the judge. And what would probably happen if I have a mother there with her attorney, the father there with his attorney, and they'd all be advocating each position, and then the judge would have to make the decision. And that's the part I didn't get. Okay? So... sorry for that long discussion. I went, what?
And we, I think a missing point, though, is that at least in Multnomah County, in my experience, the district attorney's, deputy district attorney is also there who prosecuted the abuse case to make sure that the state's interest in protection. So I think that's my assumption is that that's what their role is. But
from what I understood in the hallway, that's correct, and that the DAs in Multnomah County are very involved in this because it's such a big county and they have so many cases, they've become very expert at it, and they're going to keep doing it. Some of the other issues involved are in some of the smaller counties, they probably don't have as much expertise in this available in the DA's office, and the DAs are pulling out. So it's very complicated cases, very difficult cases, and it was illuminating in the hallway, okay? I'll just say that.
Well, like I said, it's my hope to pull everyone together and at least try to come up with a solution.
One thing, Madam Chair, is my experience is CASA does a tremendous job, but how can you ask people to do what they do and don't even get reimbursed for their travels or anything, which sometimes can take them out of states, several states, mm-hmm. to represent? And I think there's a lot of money to be saved if we could some way at least fund some of their expenses to get, because it's hard to recruit someone to do that. They're very dedicated and very effective. I would agree with Senator Bates, but some way that could help in this system, I don't know. Just trying to think out of the box.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Boss.
Thank you. Next is co-chairs, members of the committee, Fred Boss, Deputy Attorney General. Next we'll have General Counsel Division.
Chair Williamson, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is Steve Wolf. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Department of Justice's General Counsel Division. We're the division that provides the day-to-day legal services to the agencies and officers of the state. Our work takes largely 4 forms. We provide advice to the state agencies on legal issues. We perform contract review and provide transaction advice. We represent agencies in contested cases and other types of litigation. And we provide trainings to state agencies and personnel. This is our organizational chart. You'll notice we have 138 positions. Over 70% of those are attorney positions. I think 98 or 99 of those are attorney positions. The rest of our professional staff. Our budget, we are other funded entirely by our billed hours to our client agencies. We have no policy option packages. The increase in our budget is entirely inflation driven and driven by the other essential packages. I would note that 82% of our budget is personal services. That is largely our personnel costs, attorneys and staff. We have our services and supplies, largely irreducible, is also very small, but that becomes very important when we're talking about the effect of the 10% reductions. The 10% reductions would have a serious and detrimental effect on our ability to do business. It would result in a loss of 18 positions, primarily, again, because of the way we're structured, largely attorney positions. We would try to prioritize work that is most important for public safety and public interest, so that work for our public safety clients, for our transportation clients, would receive some priority. Trainings, which I mentioned are a critical part of our work, but would have the least priority, would probably drop off the grid, as important as they are to our clients and to particularly for the long-term interests of the state. Contracts would suffer disproportionately. We have in calendar 2014, the General Counsel Division opened 6,590 matters. Almost half of those were contract matters, 3,468, and the 3,268. And those we would have to either reduce the amount of scrutiny we're able to give them, extend the time it takes to scrutinize them, or eliminate by waiving some categories from legal sufficiency review, some categories from review. All of those increase the risk to the state. And so the cost of the reductions, whatever might be gained, I think the costs down the road would be much greater. That's really the sum of my comments. So I'm happy to accept any questions.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not being flip. I thought of all the problems we've had in our government in the last 6 months, you're going to have more cases, but you're saying that money is going to come from the executive branch or DAS or whatever to pay your attorneys. Is that, I would expect you're going to need more attorneys to defend the people that are being subpoenaed and things like that by the federal government. Can you address that? And also, I don't know if this is the division deputy boss, but we passed the education bill in full Ways and Means, and there was a statement by PERS board that there was errors and people were overpaid $6 million, and the PERS board decided it was not economical to try to get that. Did they ask for your advice or to confirm that it wasn't worth time to go after the $6 million of overpayment? Is that one of the services that your office would provide?
Chair Williamson, Representative Wisnant, I think Deputy Boss would be best positioned to answer at least the first question, perhaps the second one as well.
I'm sorry, I was concentrating on the second question, and could you refresh my recollection on the first?
Part of your job is representing the people that are being subpoenaed by the federal government, and is that not going to be a big burden, or does that money come from those agencies and not to your job?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Wisnant, the Department of Justice is representing the agencies with production of documents for the United States subpoenas on the Kitsop or Hayes matter. We are not necessarily representing the individuals that are involved.
But they had to, they asked.
The individuals are allowed to seek to petition DAS to provide for outside counsel for them to defend for the inquiries from from the FBI. We primarily, we solely represent the agencies, and in what is becoming a massive production of documents to the FBI. We are not absorbing that ourselves. That we have are in the process of working out an arrangement between LFO and DAS and us to coordinate it and have a centralized billing source, which will be us, but we are going to receive money from other sources.
Thank you very much for clarifying. And did Dispers ask for your advice on collecting the overpayment? Are you getting, that's an agency, so I guess you're an agency. So.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I don't recall that specific advice. I can go and check and get back to you, unless Mr. Wolf.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisnett, I don't know. PERS does consult us on a number of issues. They may very well have consulted on that one, but
don't
I don't know.
Don't spend your time and effort looking at that. I'll do some more. Thank you.
Senator Bates.
Thank you. First, thank you. I believe you're the ones who, your department, or division, worked through the courts to win two recent findings for us that we could keep enrolling Oregon Health patients into the system using software and hardware from Oracle. That was really big for us. That's a huge thing. Mm-hmm. And keeping the database we needed from Backpass records, so I appreciate that, and thank you both for winning that for us. It would have been a mess if you hadn't done it. And the other question I've got is, when you look at, as you look at contracts, is it your job or your responsibility to make sure they're a legal document, or do you also give advice? I mean, on some of these contracts, I look for the agency to give advice, OHA or DAS, to say, yeah, it's a good contract, good deal, you should do this. Do you have a responsibility to step in and say, this is legal, but it's probably not a good thing, you should be thinking twice about this?
Chair Williamson, Chair Shield, Senator Bates. First, on the first point you raised, I would say while General Counsel did have a role in that, that was a collaborative effort of many of the divisions of the Department of Justice, and I think we're, as an organization, proud of the work that we have done and are continuing to do on that. With regard to the contract review, there are a couple of components of what we do. One is the mandatory legal sufficiency review, which is strictly to determine, is this a lawful contract? Does it contain the needed mandatory terms? Does it contain sufficient protections for the state under the particular circumstances in which the contract is being entered into? On the second issue, we certainly can provide that advice. We do that largely at the request of the agencies. Often we will offer the advice when we see something that we think is not strictly within the legal sufficiency realm, but something that we think we have a responsibility as the state's attorneys to comment on. But we do defer to the business judgment of the policymakers with regard to overall the desirability of the deal and the overall goal that is being pursued.
Quick follow-up. In our state, most contracts go well, do well, and you've referenced like 3,000 you look at every year or something. But in the IT realm, I'm about to talk about Cover Oregon. In the IT realm, generally speaking, we have really struggled with multiple programs that have failed. Maybe we should have a conversation that, even though it's expensive, that your division should be looking a little more from the point of view of, if they haven't asked you for your advice, maybe they should. And when I have a great attorney that I work with as an example, and when I go into a business deal, which I have four or five, they're fairly complex, he makes sure everything's what I call hokey-dokey, everything's done right. But I also ask him for his advice. What do you think about this? And I would hope that the other agencies, when they come, especially in IT situations, ask you for your best advice also.
Chair Williamson, Chair Shields, Senator Bates, we are very happy to provide that kind of advice, and we like to get engaged at that level, and many of our clients do engage us in those issues. Some do not, some deliberately do not, and we struggle with that. But I know that we continue to work on those issues. We're working collaboratively with DAS on some initiatives to get a more robust contract review and certain kinds of contracts, and certainly with regard to IT issues, that's something that we give a particular emphasis to, and we're currently in the process of recruiting a new IT contracting specialist into our business transactions section.
That's great.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, this concludes our presentation. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
So the next couple of slides are just a consolidation of the 10% cut lists. And thank you, Monica. Any questions?
And the vacant positions.
And the vacant positions, yes. That's 86, I believe. Yep. All right. There are no questions. I will anything? Okay, sorry. I will close the public hearing on 5516. Mr. Borden, is there anything for...
State police on Monday, and so
excellent. All right, we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Okay.
Excellent. All right, we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Okay.